It's a great pleasure to have Isaac Kim. So Isaac obtained a PhD from Caltech, and after that, he actually came to Perimeter as a postdoc, and then he moved to IBM and to Stanford and PsiQuantum, and then now he is a faculty member at the University of Sydney. Now, as his career trajectory shows, he has done lots of interesting works in various fields of quantum information. Now, when I first met Isaac at Caltech, I remember that he was studying the problem related to topological quantum field theory and area law and these things. And then back then, I thought this problem is too difficult and I stayed away from it. But it seems Isaac kept working on it and making interesting progresses. So today you will see a bit of this exciting recent development from Isaac. So Isaac, please.
Okay, thanks for the very nice introduction and thanks for the invitation. And thanks everyone for coming. So as Benny said, this is the kind of work that I've been working on for quite some time. So if you look at the title, you might think that this is a bit all over the place, area law, topological quantum field theory, and quantum marginal problem. But there is actually a surprising connection between all three. And I'm quite excited to tell you about this in this talk. So to tell you where I'm coming from, I want to begin with a little story that you are all familiar with. So this is a story of an apple. And it's not the apple that you might be thinking. It's the apple that is related to Isaac Newton. So if you're a physicist, which you probably all are, you probably know this story. So Newton was contemplating about the nature of gravitation, you know, beneath his apple tree. Then an apple fell onto him. And somehow the legend says that at that moment he realized that the mass that appears in the gravitational force and the mass that appears in his second law are actually the same mass. Okay. And we all know that this is really the basis behind Newton's theory of gravitation, which led to many applications, not just in science, but also in engineering, et cetera, et cetera. And even back then, this must have been a very interesting development because before then, there was this thing called Kepler's third law, which was merely an empirical fact. But once you accept Newton's theory, this becomes a logical consequence of the Kepler's third law becomes a logical consequence of Newton's theory, which you can derive, which is very nice. And the reason why I'm leading out with this little story is because I wanted to tell you about something similar, but in a different context. And I really wanted to emphasize the power of simple but powerful physical axioms in the context of quantum many body systems. So the physical context that I'm thinking is you have a lots of particles and they interact locally with each other via some generic Hamiltonian like this. And this is a difficult problem to solve, obviously. There's a whole industry around this. And I like to claim that there's a simple axiom which is plausible, that makes quantum many-body physics in some sense solvable. So this would be the main topic of this talk. So the key is what is known as the area law in the literature. So some of you may have already heard what area law is, but for those of you who haven't, let me just give you a brief recap. So over the past, say 20 to 30 years, people have been studying the entanglement properties of many-body quantum systems, either using solvable models or using quantum field theory methods. And what they found is that for many physical states at low energy, like the ground state or states with a few excitations, the entanglement entropy tends to obey the area law, meaning that the entropy is upper bounded by its area as opposed to its volume. And because generic many-body quantum state obeys volume law of entanglement entropy, this suggests that the quote-unquote physical states that naturally appear at low energy are only constitute a very small corner of the Hilbert space. And our job as a physicist is to understand this structure, understand the universal structure of states that underlies these physical states so that we can in some sense, solve these challenging problems. And indeed, there's a good and interesting success story in this matter of theory and slash quantum information. And this is the problem of solving 1D quantum many body systems with a spectral gap. So this is a many body quantum system that interacts locally on a 1D line, 1D chain. And there is a gap between the ground state energy and the first excited energy in the thermodynamic limit. It turns out that you can solve this problem in two different senses. You can, given a microscopic model, you can calculate its energy efficiently on a classical computer. And also you can classify all possible quantum phases that are consistent with this assumption. So in some sense, we know exactly what is possible. And given a microscopic model, we can essentially obtain its energy and the underlying quantum phase. So I would say this is a fair definition of being solvable. The fundamental insight behind this well-known example is the area law. So Hastings showed roughly 15 years ago that if you cut the system into half and compute the entanglement entropy of, let's say, half of the entire system, the entropy is upper bounded by a constant independent of the system size. And this suggests that the underlying system is in some sense very weakly entangled because the amount of entanglement is very small compared to what is possible in what is possible in principle. And indeed, he showed not only the area law, but that if you obey area law, then the ground state can be well approximated by a tensor network called matrix product state. So what this tells you is that by making use of the fact that the underlying state is area law, you can in some sense obtain a normal form that is applicable to all possible gapped phases in 1D systems. So once you obtain this normal form, you can imagine using this to efficiently calculate the ground state energy variationally, or classifying all possible phases that are compatible with this tensor network diagram. Good. And since then, there has been a lot of speculations on what would happen in higher dimensions. So the big open problem is what happens in higher dimensions in, let's say, in two dimensions with a quantum many body systems in two dimensions or three dimensions with a constant spectral gap. Now, you can imagine carrying out a similar program. So I think the consensus in the community is that, well, the successful program would look like this. So somehow, starting from the gap assumption, you can prove that the entanglement entropy obeys an area law in a sense that the entropy is upper bounded by its area. And there has been some interesting recent progress by Anurag Anshu and David Gossett, which some of you may already know. However, there are some challenges in this program. I think this challenge is not itself as a deal breaker, but I just wanted to mention that even if you can prove area law, there are results in the literature showing that that alone won't be sufficient to prove that the underlying state can be well described by 2D tensor network. So the gist of this paper is that you can consider two sets. One is a set of states that satisfies area law. Yes, there was a question. I'm not sure. Can you unmute yourself? Or
yes, hi, how are you? So this is a question I've been wanting to ask for a while, and I think I know how to ask it now. There's this interesting parallel history in which in quantum gravity, we discovered that the area law was natural years and years ago. It has to do with the relationship of general relativity to topological field theory, which makes the area law natural. So it's natural to ask, is if the area law applies in nature to the kinds of systems you study, is this somehow because implicitly they couple to gravity?
So good questions. Yes, go ahead.
Is there any relation between the fact that if, I'll put it the other way, if you could couple your systems to gravity, then there would be reason for them naturally to have ground states that obey the area law?
That would be interesting to know. So I don't know the answer to this question, but it would be interesting to know. And in fact, soon I will, the kinds of area law that I need will be a little bit more precise. And it would be good to understand whether the systems that we consider obeys the area law in the sense that I describe in the next slide.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, thanks for the question. And if you don't mind, could you lower your hand? It looks like you're asking the question.
Sorry, can I? I'm confused by why would it have anything to do with gravity? It is just some spin models and so on. Maybe I'm confused, but maybe misunderstood Lee's question. But why do you think it could have anything to do with gravity? I do not understand that.
So I don't know. I'm just saying that it'll be interesting if there is a connection, but yeah, perhaps we can. Yeah.
Why would there be, and why would you imagine that there could be?
I don't see any particular reason why it would be yet, but for me, I'm a pragmatic person, so what I care about is whether the underlying system would base on area law or not. And if it is satisfied, then there are certain things that you can show. But if it's not, then the things that I will show you in this talk will be inapplicable. I'll just put it at that.
Well, the argument I had in mind goes through the Bekenstein bound, the original Bekenstein bound. But this is not this talk. So I'd be glad to chat about that later.
Okay, sure. All right, so yeah, anyway, the point that I was trying to make was that this program is likely to suffer from some problem, which seems to be challenging. But this is the point at which I would like to wear my physicist hat, and instead of trying to prove area law from the gap assumption, I like to simply assume that it is true because it has been corroborated in many examples and consider its consequences very seriously. The kind of area law that I would like to have is an area law that was proposed by these authors roughly 15 years ago. So the area law that I said in the previous slide is merely an upper bound, meaning that if you have a subsystem, it says that the entropy is upper bounded by its area. But since then, many people actually calculated the integument entropy and found that at least if the underlying system is gapped, you have this precise scaling form. You have a leading non-universal contribution divergent piece and a subleading term, which is independent of the small changes in the microscopic physics. The main point of this talk would be that if you believe that this equation is correct, then there's a sense in which the 2D quantum Mangalli physics can be solved. So before I tell you what I mean by solving quantum many-body physics, I just wanted to point out that you may think this equation is very special and fine-tuned, but it's really not, because many people have studied all sorts of different models, and they, which I mean they calculated the entanglement entropies, and they have corroborated this formula. Now, having said that, there are some weird counterexamples, which I would love to talk about. But if you're curious about that, you can ask me towards the end of the talk. So what do I mean by solving? When I say solving, I really mean two things, which are analogous to the successful results in the 1D program. In the 1D program, starting from a microscopic assumption, you were able to classify all possible quantum phases, and you are able to classically simulate this system. And I think this both of them should be a worthy goal. And I would like to tell you about the recent progress in both of these directions. So let me start with the classification problem. So there's a current belief that 2D gap phases are expected to be characterized by the topological quantum field theory, which is in turn characterized by a set of abstract data, which must obey a set of non-trivial relations. So the guiding question that I would like to ask is that, can you somehow derive TQFT from the area law? By which I mean, can you not only extract these topological data, but also the relationships that these topological data must satisfy. And at first, it might look like we're asking too much because area law seems like a very generic assumption. But I will argue that, so just to be clear, we don't know the complete answer to this yet, but there are mounting evidences that we can. And I'll tell you about these evidences. The main puzzle is this. So TKFT prescribes not just about a single data about a single ground state, but it tells you about what kind of ground state degeneracy you have if you have a closed manifold. And it tells you about the braiding statistics of the Lorentz excitations. And it seems a bit unreasonable that simply from the aerial assumption, you can somehow extract all of these data. It looks like you're putting in very little and asking a lot. However, in the past, there has been some observations that this areola formula does have a non-trivial constraint on the Lorentz physics, such as the ground state degeneracy, as well as the braiding statistics of the Lorentz excitations. However, these past works were at the level of inequality. It said something like, if this gamma is less than 2, then the ground state degeneracy over a torus is upper bounded by 2 to the 2, or something along that line. But over the past 2 years, these inequalities have been essentially all changed into equalities that we expect to be true in the TQFT. So it turns out that just starting from this assumption, you could extract some of the modular data of the underlying theory, and you can derive the constraints, the equations that these data should satisfy, which you can derive from TQFT, but in our case, only from this assumption. And moreover, you can deduce what we believe is a new kind of topological data and the identities, which hasn't been discovered so far. So we decided to only recently call this program as the entanglement bootstrap program, because we think this is important. And in the entanglement bootstrap program, we're asking this central question, broadly speaking. So we're asking, say we have a quantum many body state that obeys this aerial assumption locally everywhere on every constant size ball. And we're asking what is the space of all possible quantum states which are consistent with these constraints. So for instance, you can consider a subsystem like an annulus, or if you like, you can consider a disk or a disk with two holes, anything that you want. And you demand that locally everywhere on every constant size ball, you obey this entropy law constraint. Okay, so this question might seem a little vague, but it turns out that this is a very precise mathematical problem with a highly non-trivial structure. The way I like to think about this program is in some sense an analogy with the conformal bootstrap program. So I'm not an expert on conformal bootstrap and my understanding is very tenuous, but my understanding is that in this program, you impose a set of physical axioms such as unitarity and conformal symmetry, which imposes non-trivial constraints on the physical objects such as the correlation functions. But you deal with the more economical data such as the scaling dimensions and the OPE coefficients. And these physical axioms translate into non-trivial constraints on these fundamental data, from which you can even like solve the theory without even ever knowing the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian. And we have a similar situation in the entanglement bootstrap program, but of course the details differ. So the physical axiom is precisely the area law, the form of the area law that I have proposed in the previous slides. And the physical objects, as I've told you in the previous slide, are the density matrices over possibly different subsystems. But these objects are somewhat abstract and difficult to work with, and they don't really capture the essence of the physics. So one needs to somehow extract the fundamental data that is suitable for extracting the universal physics. And that's what we call as the information context set. And I want to tell you a little bit more about that. So suppose you have, again, some reference state. You can imagine it being a ground state of some local Hamiltonian, which obeys this area law everywhere. locally. And you consider some subsystem like omega, okay? And it doesn't have to be an annulus, but I picked an annulus for concreteness. So I will zoom that up, okay? And then what I would like to demand is that I look at every constant size ball, and on that constant size ball, I want to consider a density matrix over sigma, which is consistent with the sigma. So they are locally indistinguishable with the sigma over these constant size balls. But there's an ambiguity because, for instance, this ball here, part of it is like lying outside of this region omega. And the way we deal with this is that we simply extend this subsystem to, let's say, omega tilde, and then consider the locally indistinguishable states. And then you trace out this boundary region, so to speak. And the resulting set is what we call as the information convex set of omega. And throughout this talk, we'll call this as sigma of omega. So I have to concede that this definition is a bit abstract and it's totally unclear why this has anything to do with physics, but I will tell you soon why and what the physical meaning of this is. But before I do that, I just wanted to mention that you might think that this information convex set is a very generic object. It doesn't have much structure. And generally, if you have a general quantum many-body state, that would be true. But the state that we have is not arbitrary state, but the state that obeys this area law assumption. And that has an important consequence. So if you assume that this area law assumption holds locally everywhere, then you can verify very easily that you can often find a linear combination which vanishes. Linear combinations of entangled entropies which vanish. So this will be one example. And for this particular linear combination, if they do vanish, then there's a it turns out that the underlying state has a very nice structure called quantum Markov chain structure. So this is one of the important results in quantum information. So what we know is that if you assume area law is true, then you end up getting quantum Markov chains on the marginals in all sorts of different regions. And this is important because quantum Markov chains have a very special structure. So let's say you want to construct this state ABC over these three subsystems. It turns out that if this condition is satisfied, you can begin with a marginal density matrix over, say, this red and green region, and apply some linear map that only acts on the blue and the green region. The important point is that this linear map doesn't act on the entire red, green, and blue, but only acts on the green and the blue. So the fact that there's this local linear map that can somehow extend the local reduced density matrix to a more global density matrix leads to an important consequence on the shape or the geometry of the information convex set. So what should be clear is that the information convex set is a convex set, but that alone is not very descriptive because all these examples, they are convex, but clearly they are all different. An important result is that the shape of the information convex set only depends on the topology of the underlying subsystem. So for instance, if you have an annulus and if you have a slightly deformed annulus, it turns out that their information convex sets are equivalent to each other in a sense that there's a linear map that maps the left-hand side to the right-hand side and vice versa. Moreover, this linear map preserves the distance between the elements of the set. So up to this equivalence relation, the shape of the, up to this equivalence relation, you can see that the information convex set only depends on the topology of the underlying subsystem. And moreover, the shape itself is not just some arbitrary stuff. It has, it's in some sense a very nice geometry. So if you have a disk, you just have a single element. So you have a trivial topology. If you have a disk with one hole, you have a simplex. So imagine like an n-dimensional Euclidean space with the basis vectors, which are all orthogonal to each other. And if you have disk with two holes, then it turns out that you have an n-dimensional sphere. So that's kind of cool, but what does it all mean? It turns out that all these statements have a corresponding statements in the theory of anyon, or TQFT. So the fact that the information convex set is topologically invariant means that there is a globally well-defined notion of topological charges and fusion spaces. No matter where you are, if you define a fusion space or topological charge in a particular region, there's a map that relates that topological charge to a topological charge in another region. And the information convex set over the annulus corresponds to the superselection sectors. And the information convex set with two holes on a disk corresponds to the fusion space of the anion, let's say A and B fusing into anion C. So that's about how to extract the modular data from the aerial assumption. But it turns out that there is more. In TQFT, we expect these data to be not just some arbitrary stuff, but we expect them to satisfy a set of non-trivial equations that relates each other, such as these. And it's a priori not clear whether we can recover these equations just from this aerial assumption. But it turns out that you can. The key idea is again the fact that the underlying state is a quantum Markov chain. So I've already told you that if you assume that the area law holds, then the underlying reference state obeys the quantum Markov chain condition. Yes, there was a question.
I want to ask about this area law assumption. You said it is applicable to O1 set subsystem. So
right.
In this case, how are we supposed to separate the two terms?
Which term? Oh, I see. Oh, you mean like these two?
Yeah.
So what I actually need is that I want a some linear combination of entangled entropies to be vanished in a constant side region. But I don't really need this assumption per se. So the statement would be that the kinds of equations that I actually need are something like this. So insofar as you satisfy this equation, it doesn't really matter whether you have an area or whatever. But I have some specific linear combinations in my mind from which all the results follow.
I see. But maybe one other question is, here, have you already somehow assumed that this system is gapped?
So if they're not gapped, this won't be a very reasonable assumption.
Which one? The upper one? Or
both, but especially this one.
I guess for the upper one, gamma would depend on a lot of details if it's gapless.
That's right. So in particular, you have like a log L term, which will be very difficult to cancel out.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the quantum Markov chain condition can be extended to not just to this reference state, but in fact, arbitrary element in the information convex set. The important point is that in the information convex set, some of its elements will be the reduced sense matrix of the original state, but some of them will be new states, which are a priori unrelated to that state. But even for those states, one can actually show that they sort of satisfy a Markov chain condition. So why is that important? It's important because I want you to focus on the title, is because there's a sense in which if you have two Markov chains, you can combine them into forming a new, like a larger Markov chain. So a non-trivial example that I like to have in my mind is this picture. So you have two subsystems, X and Y, and they overlap in this middle region, okay? And if there's a sense in which this density matrix over X is a Markov chain and a density matrix over Y is a Markov chain, then you can combine them together to form a new Markov chain on this combined system, X union Y. And moreover, these three states, the density matrix over X, density matrix over Y and the density matrix over X union Y, they are non-trivially related by this identity. So on the right-hand side, you have the entanglement entropies of subsystems, which are defined in terms of your original data, rho X and lambda Y. And on the left-hand side, you have some density matrix, which you don't know exactly, but it turns out that this density matrix has to be the maximum entropy state of this information convex set of X union Y. And remember I told you that the information convex set of this disk with two annulus is actually a sphere. So because you have such a nice geometry, you can actually find an analytic expression for the left-hand side. So what you end up having is that you have an expression for the right-hand side and the left-hand side, establishing some equality. And this identity seems to be very powerful because applied to different setups, it leads to equations like fusion rules, definitions of quantum dimensions, S matrix, Verlander formula, all sorts of different things that you would expect to be true. So that is it, the fact that you can derive all this known stuff from area law is kind of interesting, but what is truly interesting is that this line of thinking seems to lead to new physics and equations, which hasn't been known before. So far, I've only assumed that this entanglement entropy satisfies the area law in the sense that you have the non-universal divergent term, and the sub-leading term, which is independent of where the subsystem is. But you can imagine a situation in which this subleading term depends on where the subsystem is, so that you can add a dependence on the location, let's say A, okay? So this will be a relaxation of the original assumption. And by simply doing that, you can actually deduce the existence of topological charges and fusion spaces, which are new to the best of our knowledge. And these charges obey a generalization of the fusion rule, which we refer to as a quasi-fusion rule. And moreover, turns out that you can assign an invariant to the domain wall. The physical situation that I'm thinking is that there's a domain wall between two gapped phases, the green region and the white region. And it turns out that you can assign a entropic topological invariant to the domain wall, which you can compute exactly from the internal self-consistency relations of this formula. So as I said, the physical context that I'm thinking is a situation of having a gapped domain wall. So imagine you have two different gapped phases. So you have P phase and Q phase. Imagine like P being, for instance, like a toric coat phase, and Q being like a double Ising anion or something, but something different. Okay. And previously, people have studied these situation of gap domain walls by folding the system. And once you fold the system, you end up having some topological gapped phase on this P union Q. And down here, you have a gapped boundary to the vacuum. In this way, by reducing to the gapped boundary problem, you can classify the phases and understand the boundary excitation, et cetera, et cetera. So you can carry out the same analysis to this setup, and you more or less get what people have discovered in the past. But it turns out that there are new objects that very naturally appear in the entanglement bootstrap program, which does not seem to have any analogs in the known theory of gapped domain walls. So it's interesting to understand what these new objects correspond to. And this is a vast subject and I won't have time to tell you about everything, but I just wanted to tell you about a few things that I find interesting. There was a chat. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, I'll send you the slides later. Okay. So this is what we call as the parton sectors. So as you know, partons subdivide known particles. And let's just start with the name. So we have two types of sectors. One is the n-type sector because it This is a topological charge that you can measure by some measurement process localized on this blue region. So this looks like little n, so we call this n-type sector. And similarly, we call this as u-type sector. And these Parton sectors, I would like to emphasize, they are not like point light excitations. And what I mean by that is that just by, even if you specify only a Parton sector, that alone does not give you enough information to specify the topological data of the excitation. So an excitation in the existing literature views an excitation as some topological charge that you can measure on this blue region. But these Parton sectors are in some sense subdividing these known topological charges. And an important point that is worth mentioning is that if you fix alpha, then you get a unique Parton sector. But even if you fix N and U, that alone does not specify alpha uniquely. So in some sense, you can weakly measure the topological charge in certain situations by simply measuring N and U sector instead of this alpha sector. So this can be a bit confusing. So I just wanted to point out that there is two different ways of defining a superselection sector. One is by explicitly constructing a unitary operator that creates an excitation. So this is an example of a string operator that extends to infinity that creates a localized point-like excitation. So this would be the way in which people usually define a topological charge. However, if you think about it, what should really matter is what are the kind of things that you can measure. So one is that one thing that you can measure is by applying some presumably Ehrhardt-Bohm type of experiment along this annulus. But there are experiments that you can do on these half loops that can either measure N and U separately. And somehow this leads to a more refined set of information. And you can actually detect these Parton sectors from the ground state entanglement. That will come later. And I just wanted to tell you that these Parton sectors also satisfy a generalization of diffusion rule. So when you have a fusion of two topological charges, let's say A and B fusing into C, usually the leftover degrees of freedom are described by some Hilbert space. But it turns out that for partons, there are situations in which you fuse parton N and parton N prime to form a parton N double prime, but you won't have a single Hilbert space, but you will have two different Hilbert spaces, which corresponds to two different sectors. So you can play this game of constructing systematically objects in the entanglement bootstrap program and thinking about what those means in the theory of gapped domain walls. So it seems like you are getting a more refined set of information this way. And you can actually detect, there's a sense in which you can detect the Parton sectors from the ground state entanglement. If you consider this linear combination of entanglement entropy, just from the assumption on this area law alone, you can derive an exact expression. And what I want to point out furthermore is that these dn squares are not just some arbitrary numbers. They are numbers that must satisfy a set of equations, which are specified in terms of integers, like n's here and here, these are just integer. So there's a sense in which this object is highly constrained and doesn't have a continuous spectrum. Okay, so I keep saying this, but I think it's important to say it again that throughout all of this analysis, we really only assumed that the underlying global state obeys this entropy law locally everywhere. And I think it's kind of amazing that you can actually discover new kinds of topological charges and diffusion rules, and that the fact that you can also derive an exact expression for the analog of the topological entanglement entropy on the domain wall is pretty mind-boggling. So this alone itself is not a classification because we're merely playing with this formalism so far. But because we were able to rediscover what is already known in the literature from a simple assumption, and because we were able to derive new things that was not known before, I think this is at least a very promising approach to classify what is possible in 2D quantum many body physics. So that ends the first part of my talk. And now I want to switch gears a little bit and tell you a bit about why I think this equation is also important for classical simulation of these systems.
Isaac, I have a question. Mm-hmm. So does your result tell anything about like how to prepare the state, like the global state?
Okay. So I guess we never wrote a paper about it, but the answer is yes. There are some subtleties on the boundary condition. So let's imagine you have a cylinder. Then what you can do is that you can, if you start with a cylinder with a unit, if you begin with a single slice of the cylinder with a constant width, there's a sequence of local recovery channel that extends this state to basically a an infinite cylinder.
But then if you have, let's say, two states, and then is there any way of showing that they belong to the same phase or a different phase? Like if topological invariant are different, it's different, but let's say, is there any way of smoothly connecting two? Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think like showing them that they're equal up to local unitary equivalence is a very difficult problem. So I don't have anything interesting to say. So this, but showing that two things are different, we believe currently that things such as the fusion space dimension is likely to be invariant under some local unitary transformation. But it's something that we need to think about a bit more. There's a subtlety because you're aware of this, but there is this thing called spurious topological entanglement entropy. And those are problems, but those things can be created or destroyed by finite depth quantum circuit. So like the challenge is to identify a structure which you can derive from the area law, but which is still invariant under this local depth unitary circuits.
And how about like small errors in the area law?
Does it add up? It depends. So if you apply that, if you consider a constant size subsystem, and if you have an error of epsilon, I expect that if you want to make the statements about arbitrarily large system, which is like, let's say, k times the original size, I expect the error to scale as k times epsilon.
Okay.
But yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Can I ask a quick question? So are the braiding phases also determined from some kind of entanglement structure?
Braiding. So Bowen did that. So Bowen was able to extract the S matrix, but we don't know how to extract the T matrix.
I see. Thanks.
Good. So in the second part of the talk, I wanted to lead with this very simple problem, which some of you may have heard, but some of you may have not heard. It's called a marginal problem. So what is given to you is this is a classical problem, by the way. So what is given to you is a probability distribution over two random variables, xy, yz, and xz. And the question that you want to answer is whether there exists a global probability distribution over x, y, and z, which are consistent with these three data. Of course, such a thing may or may not exist, depending on this precise data. And if they do exist, if such a thing does exist, we say that these things are globally consistent. And there's a very natural analog in the quantum case, which is unsurprisingly called as the quantum marginal problem. So here, what you do is that you basically replace the marginal probabilities to marginal density matrices. So you have xy, yz, and xz. And you want to understand whether there is a global state rho tilde, which is consistent with these degree data. And if there is such a thing, again, we say that these marginal density matrices are globally consistent. So why should I care? You should care because if you can actually solve this problem, then the payoff is pretty big. So for many body systems, you often had a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of local terms. So its expectation value can be expressed as a sum of the local expectation values over the marginals. So if you can somehow find a condition under which these guys are consistent, then you can potentially reduce this exponential complexity of finding the ground state energy to a polynomial complexity. And that would be amazing, but of course, there's no free lunch. Generally, it's difficult to solve this problem. So the real question is, for physical states, can you actually efficiently check that if these things are consistent? So this problem is a very old problem, and it dates even go back to 1959. And this guy is Charles Colson. He's one of the first quantum chemists who studied the structure of benzene, for example. And he noticed that in order to calculate the energy, you don't really need the global wave function. All you need is the reduced density matrices over a constant size region. So if you can somehow find the condition under which these density matrices are compatible with this global state, then that will be very useful in minimizing the finding the ground state energy. And in the quantum case, this is a very difficult problem because already in the very simple case of having a 3 qubits, this problem seems pretty challenging. So say you have a maximally entangled state over A, B, and B, C. Then even though they're marginal on B, are both maximally entangled, mixed states, and as such they are equal to each other, there cannot be any state over ABC which is compatible with both rho AB and lambda BC, right? Because that would violate the monogamy of entanglement. So compare that to the classical case, in which if you have two density matrices which commute with each other, which is the case in the classical case, and if they are equal on the marginal, then you can construct this state, which is consistent with both rho AB and lambda BC. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that this problem in the classical case is easy, but in the quantum case, even this simple example is a non-trivial problem. And imagine how difficult the problem will be when you extend it to a many-body setting. So it's so now we have a better understanding of why this problem is so difficult. It turns out that this problem is likely to be difficult even for a quantum computer. So there's no hope for finding a general solution. And in fact, Mary Best, who's famous for proving the strong subadditivity of entropy, once told me that once every few decades, new scientists come over and work on this problem and they get defeated and they disappear from the academia, and then new generation of scientists comes in and repeat the same mistake. And of course, she was half joking, but the history was, what she said was not untrue. But recently, due to some advances in quantum information, interesting progress has been made. So, and obviously, we cannot expect to have a general condition, so this condition is special. It only applies to a certain family of states. But it's still, I would like to argue that it's still interesting and physically relevant. So just to give you some perspective, very abstractly speaking, there will be, in a many-body system, there will be a set of marginal density matrices, which may or may not be compatible with each other. And the things that we truly care about are the consistent marginal density matrices, that are the marginals of some actual global quantum state. And in fact, we want not only that, we want to be able to somehow verify that these local marginal density matrices are compatible with some global state. So let's zoom up that part. So you probably all know that the mean field onset would be a trivial example of that. So given a marginal row one, row two, dot, 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 row n, obviously their tensor product is compatible with row one, row two, dot, 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 row n. So that's a trivial example. Everybody knows that. But the new solution subsumes this in a sense that it includes mean field solutions as a special case, but parts of it, there are solutions in that family, which lie strictly outside of the mean field case. And moreover, they're physically relevant, and there's a linear time algorithm for computing its the energy and the entropy of the underlying state. So what is this solution? Roughly speaking, the solution that you need turns out to be precisely what I've been telling you throughout this talk. It's the area law assumption on constant size system. So just to be clear, what we actually proved was under another assumption that there is a translational invariance in the underlying marginal, but I believe this is just a technicality. And the way this works is somewhat similar to what I told you, one of the strategies that I've told you. It's based on the fact that if you have two Markov chains, you can somehow combine them together to form a larger Markov chain. So in our context, the argument will look like this. So you begin with this entropy law assumption on constant size system, and you verify that these conditions are satisfied on these two different types of subsystems. And so what you actually need is not exactly this, but just this. So insofar as this is correct, then you're good to go. But in any case, you have these two density matrices, like the left side and the right side. And from the fact that you can combine two Markov chains to form a new Markov chain, you can form a new state over these union of these two regions. And the important point is that this new thing is again a Markov chain. So it turns out that you can chain this argument over and over to extend the density matrix to an arbitrarily large system. So this will be a kind of a caricature of what's happening in this work. So you start with small Markov chains and you combine them to a larger Markov chain. And concurrently, you have other two Markov chains combined into another Markov chain. So you combine these two to a larger Markov chain and just repeat something like this. The big question is, okay, it's fine, you can do that. But the big question is how local can you make the Markov chain assumption to ensure the global consistency? And we liked the Markov chain assumption to be as local as possible, because if there are two global, then in order to verify the Markov chain emission, you need lots of computational resource. Calculating entanglement entropy for a general many-body quantum state is not easy. There are two limits that you can think of. One is that you only have a handful of Markov chains from which you deduce the existence of some Markov chain on a global quantum many-body state. And this is the kind of situation that you would like to avoid, because if the target system that you want to create is a many-body quantum system, and if you only have three Markov chains, at least one of the three must be a Markov chain on a very large system. And verifying the Markov chain condition on that would be very difficult. The situation that you would like to have is that you have teeny bits of Markov chains sprinkled here and there, so that verifying the Markov chain conditions on those tiny bits is easy. But somehow you can combine all these assumptions together to form the many-body state. And fortunately for us, it turns out that we only need this constant size condition. So just to be concrete, I wanted to flesh out the exact condition that we need. So this notation looks a bit weird, so let me explain. So S is the entanglement entropy. So what's inside here is some notation for the reduced density matrix. So for each square, you can think of them as some local degrees of freedom. Think of it as a qubit, for example. So you have four qubits here, but when you have a gray square, that means that you're tracing out that qubit. So this would be the entropy of a three-body density matrix over these three qubits. And this would be the entropy of these two white qubits. And clearly, all these conditions are specified in a constant size region. So there's a constant size set of constraints such that if they are satisfied, then there exists a translationally invariant global state on an infinite lattice, which is compatible with these 2x2 patches. I just wanted to make a brief comment that, just to be clear, you can verify that all of these conditions do indeed fall from the area law. And one interesting side remark is that these equations actually hold even if you satisfy the volume law of entanglement entropy. The important point is if the volume law cancels out each other in the right way so that this equation holds, then you can the solution still holds. It's kind of interesting because usually you would think that whenever you have volume law, the underlying system will be difficult to simulate, but it looks like that's not always the case. And I just wanted to mention about the applicability of this result. So if all two-dimensional translationally invariant gap phases satisfy area law in the sense of this, then they should also satisfy our conditions. So in that case, one would be able to argue that our solution is applicable to all gapped quantum antibody phases in 2D. However, there is a counterexample, which are known as 2D gap systems with spurious contributions to the.
Sorry, can I just ask a very naive question? So the volume law is typically what you get for gapless systems, is it true or no?
No, like this, for ground state, it's very difficult to get volume law, but for physically relevant context, this would be relevant for finite temperature systems. So like I didn't have to assume that the global state is pure. So like given a local density matrices, all I'm asking is whether there exists a global state compatible with them.
Mm-hmm. So gapless, you have these extra logs?
That's, I don't know how to deal with them yet. This seems challenging because you need cancellations in order for this to work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. But they would cancel, right? The logarithmic singularities, the logs would cancel, but they would leave behind something finite. Is it true? Or
that's right. Yeah, that's right. They leave something finite, and if it's finite and non-vanishing, then it seems difficult to work with that.
Interesting. Funny. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. So there are counterexamples, but all the counterexamples that I know of, they can be created or destroyed by some finite depth quantum circuit. And at the end of the day, the reason why you care about this quantum marginal problem, because you're given a like a locally interacting Hamiltonian, and you want to calculate its ground state energy variationally. So you can simply remove this spurious entanglement by just applying this low-depth quantum circuit that creates a spurious entanglement in reverse. So I know this feels a bit like cheating, but the point that I'm trying to make is that up to local unitary transformation, I'm actually not aware of any 2D gap systems which violates the condition that we needed. So a speculation that I always have is that maybe our solution does cover all possible 2D gap phases. And if one can prove that, that would be pretty amazing. So I just wanted to emphasize that throughout this talk, I only assumed this. And I think it's amazing that you can derive non-trivial new statements about topological phases, and also that you can solve this challenging quantum marginal problem. So it looks like this equation, even though it looks very generic, seems to hiding a lot of structures. And it looks like not only that, you can actually use them in a very useful way. So I just want to end with the slogan. So area law, I think, is the key to solving quantum mechanical physics, at least away from the criticality. And the way I think about these problems is that under the area law, the reduced density matrices, they're sort of like the Lego blocks. So by using this Markov chain structure, you can like somehow combine them in a very precise way. And somehow this is very, very powerful. So I just wanted to thank my collaborators, without whom this work would have been impossible. And let me end this talk with this some possible future works and speculations that I have. Thanks for listening.
Okay, thanks, Isaac. So I guess we can take a few questions.
Maybe a naive question. Isaac, can you remind me, so you use the area law to derive all these things, but to me it seemed like most of the things that I can remember were actually derived from this linear extensions rather than the area law itself. So I just wanted to know.
That's right.
Why do you think that it's the area law that's the fundamental thing?
I think it's a matter of choice. So in my mind, these things are morally equivalent. So the reason that I chose area law was for the sake of presentation mostly. And I do prefer to think about these local linear combinations, to be honest. But it's, first of all, you have more than one such constraints, conditions that you impose. So I found it somewhat difficult to, you know, flesh it out in front of everyone. But having said that, I do think those assumptions are more fundamental. And in fact, some of those assumptions do actually imply area law in the form that I told you. So there's a sense in which they are equivalent to each other. It's a matter of choice. Tarun has a question.
Hi, Isaac. A very nice talk.
Hey, thanks.
About the, you mentioned these Markov conditions are also satisfied by, if you have volume law, I guess, without any subleading.
Right.
Do you have any understanding what it means for many body systems which are at finite temperature, finite energy density? Is there some interesting thing to say there, or is it just a...
It turns out that I didn't have time to talk about this, but you can actually... compute the global entropy exactly in that case. So insofar as you can do that. So you can variation upper bound the free energy, like, and this would be like a beyond mean field approximation. So I think that's kind of interesting, actually.
I see. And the other question if you have a classical system and you're trying to think about this marginal problem again, I guess then
right. One
would think that if there's suppose you're close to some critical point where the correlation and diverges or something, you should not be able to mm-hmm. do it because of this, I guess.
I agree. Yes. Yeah.
And the reason is that
to the Ising model.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess the reason is that they are subleading terms which are not constant, maybe some log n,
or
some fractional power, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what's the complexity of that?
I think if you can even simulate that, it looks like there's nothing you cannot simulate. It seems like too good to be true. But I'm not sure. I think, like, practically speaking, one would probably, if you actually end up using this approach, you'll probably do something like finite size scaling over the size of the, like, the cluster that you're considering, like what people do in, like, MPS calculations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So Isaac, I have questions. Mm-hmm. So do you have anything to say about your possible future work slide, like higher dimensions and dynamics, let's say?
Yeah, so dynamics. So obviously we didn't assume anything about the Hamiltonian. So all you needed was a state. So if you have some, yeah, I guess like, I guess that's the main strength of this approach. So I guess I don't have much to say other than the fact that one could posit that the same assumptions hold in non-equilibrium phase matter and think about its consequences. In the case of higher dimensions or like defects or symmetries, we expect this to be fairly straightforward. And in some sense, the difficulty is not the quantum information side. The technology itself can be applied, but it's mostly about the problems in topology. Like in 3D, in 2D, you can like very systematically, there's a very systematic way of like classifying the manifolds. In 3D, I believe it is done, but it's not something that we are very well versed into. And that kind of things are the main difficulty.
I see, yeah, okay, thank you.
Can I ask one more question?
Mm-hmm.
So if this condition is not satisfied exactly, but let's say with some correction, which is mm-hmm. quantifiable, is there, mm-hmm. understanding of how to scale the, I mean, here you have the idea that you can, given the small density matrices, you can make up the global one, but if there is some approximate such condition, do we know from practical point of view, will error sort of add up or will you be able to bound the error for a much bigger density matrix which doesn't scale with?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in the current strategy that I'm thinking, the error will pile up. So if you start with a constant size system and build up like an order n size system, then the rigorous upper bound on the expectation values of local observables, in the worst case, will scale with the size of the system. But in the classical case, I have some ideas on how to reduces to like order one. So the statement would be like, if this condition is violated by order epsilon everywhere, then the local expectation values are upper bound, error is upper bounded by order epsilon everywhere. But the idea that I have right now seems to be somewhat difficult to generalize to quantum case. It's mostly because things don't commute with each other. The main point is that if you have, there are some technical statements which says that if the entropy, if you're close to the maximum entropy state, so if your local expectation values are very similar to each other, and if your global entropy is close to the actual global maximum entropy, but if you have a global entropy density error bound, as opposed to like an absolute difference, then you can use that to like bound the difference in the local expectation values. So that's the strategy that I'm thinking.
I see. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very practical point of view. That might be the case most of the time.
I would believe so. Yeah, it'll be very weird if somehow the error all like constructively like pile up so that you end up getting a mess.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so I guess we had lots of interesting questions. So I think we can thank Isaac for this great talk. Thank you.